Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. I am going to keep this very brief because I've been talking way too much. Here's the plugs. Denise Scott is on today's podcast. I love Denise Scott. I don't need to tell you much more than that because I say it all to her in the podcast. You will love this one, I reckon. It's rare at the end of the podcast that I say to the guest, I love you. Normally that's probably pretty inappropriate. It may have even been when we recorded this one, but I do indeed love Denise Scott and I loved having this chat with her. She is doing a show with Judith Lucy called Disappointments that you can find all over the country still, and it's comedy.com.au. Comedy.com.au is also where you can find the details of my show, Will Legal, that I am doing for the rest of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, and then in Canberra, Sydney, and Perth. All of those are still on sale, so come out and see a show. It's the best way to support the podcast. Otherwise, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/tofop, T-O-F-O-P. At some stage, we're going to put a philosophy level in, but contributing there helps me pay for the people who helped me put this podcast together. So if you like the show and you want to hear more of it, then tell your friends, rate it, you know, do all that sort of stuff. But throw us a couple of bucks on Patreon and that helps you know, it deserves a much better intro than this. That's what I would say, but I just don't have it in me. So this is the best you're getting. Luckily, from now on, from the minute I stop talking, this podcast gets really great because Denise Scott is the best. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and we're on a bit of a run. We only put out 12 episodes in the entirety of last year, and I think we're going to put out 12 in about the first 2 months of this season. So we're very excited about the way that's going. Part of the reason for that is that it is the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, and our next guest, who I'm going to let introduce themselves in a second though, is I'm just going to say this. Normally I say this in the intro, but I'm just going to say it in front of the person. I hope it's not embarrassing to you, but one of my favourite comedians in the world. And who are you? There you go. That's it. That's the, who are you? After that, who are you?
Oh, goodness me. I'm Denise Scott. I don't know why I've gone into panto voice. I am embarrassed. But thank you. Yes, I'm Denise Scott. Is that all I've got to say?
You can say whatever you want.
I feel like I've got to say nearly 63 years old. I don't know why I need to say that.
It's interesting that you say that, though, because seeing that you've said it,
yes.
I'm going to talk about it, if that's all right.
Oh, okay. That's fine with me.
Because it wasn't something that I necessarily thought I'd bring up. But in the context of what I want to say to you, I think of you so often.
I bet you do.
Yeah. I do, Scotty.
In a sexual way.
Well, I've seen you.
Sometimes.
I've seen you in those nude suits at the end of the show many times.
Yeah, and, I've often wondered.
We've shared some intimate stories about arthritis, and I'm
sure
that
have.
Will.
While I've been wearing the nude suit.
Exactly.
So, yes.
I mean, no one can judge me. No, the thing that I was going to say is that often I am struck by my own mortality as a performer, particularly during the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. This is my 22nd year in a row, and I always wonder, when does it, is there a point where it stops, where I don't get to do this anymore, whether, you know, I won't have something interesting to say. And often when I have that conversation with myself, the first person I think of is you, because I think in the last 5 or so years, certainly to me, you're probably doing the best work you've ever done in your life. Is that something that you feel like is true?
I feel like I'm a lot more comfortable with the genre of comedy. I never felt comfortable being a stand-up comedian. I really didn't want to be one. And I've never felt, even now, I've never felt like that's my thing. Like but I haven't had any other options, really. You know, like I thought, well, I'd love to act, of course. Hello. If anyone wants me in their film or their play or, but no,
I mean,
one basically.
They could just take one in two of Shane Jacobson's roles in
Australian
films and give them to
surely
you.
Surely, you would think. But and I think the older you get though, and I don't know whether it's specific to Australia, but there's so little work opportunities, really, you know, that you keep digging deeper and deeper to survive. So whilst on the one hand, yeah, I think I'm so much more comfortable on stage and like, well, this is who I am, and I consider myself to be quite a boring, mundane, suburban voice. And that's who I am, and that's what I got, so take it or leave it. And ever since I've decided, well, that's that, things have improved, you know. I'm just more comfortable. But I think every year as I get older, oh, I don't know whether it's depression, but it's like, fucking hell, I do not know what I am going to talk about now, because right. I feel like less and less, there's less and less I know about life. I get more and more doubtful about my opinions because I know less about life. I feel like I understand it less the older I get. And I feel quite humbled and like, oh, what am I going to talk about? And hence the show I'm currently doing with Judith Lucy is kind of in many ways as shallow as you can get, because it's really all, it's on the surface, it's really just talking about the usual, you know, getting older stuff. I talk about my arthritis, and I know yours is youthful arthritis, but arthritis, I talk about, you know, age old complaints. Which, you know, I'd love to be talking about something else, but this is the other thing that's really got to me is I spent my whole career talking about family, like kids, my relationship with my kids as a mum, and they're now, you know, in their 30s. And so for like 10 years or more, I haven't been able to talk about that. And I found I didn't have anything else to say, you know, so it was a real... Oh, it's been a real struggle to find something to say.
So this is interesting to me, though, because I think that the idea that I am less certain about things and how you then express that comedically, you know, I mean, I think comedy is often very easy to do in black and white, right? I hate this. I love this. Ah. This is where comedy is, right? But the more that you age, and if you age in a way, and what you're saying is very similar to the way that I feel, like I see the world so much in, you know, various shades of grey now, and don't necessarily have, you know, definitive, defensible positions on things, or, you know, I can't be outraged about brunch. You know, like, I mean, if I was 20, I could probably have a whole 5 minutes on how outraged I was about brunch. But, like, you know, you get to a certain point and you're like, well, I can't be as definitive about this. Then you're like, well, how do I then express comedically what it is that I am trying to say? So I think it's an interesting thing. What do you think that you don't know now that you thought you knew, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, when you had a definitive idea about something that you don't now?
I guess I thought I was a lot more hippie. I believed in natural therapies. Like, I really believed in them. I believed that if you were a really loving, good parent, then everything was going to be fine with your kids. I guess I believed you had more control over your life. I also believed that I'd never have problems with having a social life, friendship, hanging out with people. I believed I would never give up on life. And I haven't given up on life, but I've really become my mother in the last couple of years, where I do spend a lot of time. I talk about it in the show, but I really spend an amazing amount of time just lying on my bed. And it's like I never thought I'd be that person. I always thought I would keep fighting the good fight and really exploring life and being excited by life and wanting to travel and wanting to keep working, you know, and have ambition. And suddenly I just packed it all up one day and went to bed. And I get out of bed to work. I get out of bed to do basic housework stuff, you know, John and I cook a meal if John won't. You know, I go shopping for food if I have to. But it's interesting. I thought I was a much more I thought I was a more positive person. Yeah, I think.
That's interesting to me. So, when did you notice that that was changing? Like, was there a particular time, or is that a thing that happens very gradually?
Weirdly, it was. And this was another thing of why the show with Judith came about, disappointments, was that my kids were both living overseas. They still do, essentially. My dog died, and I'd spent a year, like a full year immersed, like gave everything to writing a sitcom. And So the kids were gone, the dog had died, the sitcom absolutely got rejected, and it was, I think, a good decision that it got rejected. I don't think it was a really viable thing in the end. But I just felt like, I don't have to get up. Like, my dog doesn't need walking. I don't have kids to worry about. And my mum had died a few years earlier, but she took a lot of care because she had Alzheimer's. So I spent a lot of time with her. John, you know, my partner, he's as happy as can be. He's a man who's totally, like, happy to bounce around. Doesn't really notice that I'm in bed a lot. Like, he's pretty cool. So, yeah, I thought, I actually don't have anyone to look after. I don't have to do anything. And so off I went to bed. And haven't emerged properly yet. I keep thinking, tomorrow I'll bounce out.
What's in bed? Like, what's happening when you're in bed?
I do a bit of, you know, my basic work stuff, bit of email.
Yeah.
I mean,
there is something pretty great about doing your business stuff from bed, though, right?
It's gorgeous, but I don't write anything. I haven't written anything new for a while. Although, you know, these days, any sort of publicity, you usually have to do quite a bit of work on. Like, you have to write a Q&A piece for the Women's Weekly. I mean, that takes time. It does me.
It takes a lot of time.
And it
and
has to be...
the amount of unreasonable requests you get in the... Like, particularly in a time period where often you are writing a show, you know, the thing that you're actually promoting, you're working full time on that, you know, whether it be a television show, whether it be, you know, a live show or whatever. And then somebody comes to you and goes, hey, we've got 90 questions about things. If you could come up with a comical answer for all 90, we're going to choose 15. You're like, well, how about you just send me 15 for a start and I'll give my best crack at them. But I'm not going to spend hours writing something funny for something you might not even put in.
Oh, I know. And then, you know, and you get asked about stuff you don't care about. No, you've got to bring it home with a funny gag. And it's like, and I'm quite a long-winded person. And it's always, could you, you know, make it shorter? It's like, what the fuck? It's your job to write your column for your newspaper, not mine.
Right. Also, but, you know, I've developed this long-winded style because I don't have many pithy things to say. That's how I manage to do a new show all the time. I'm like,
see, you've just made me aware of that.
But that's okay.
That's
my style as well. Like, I mean, the reason that I can do shows is because, like, literally, my entire 70-minute show is about something that happened within 30 hours. It's like one flight and one arrest and a drive home. And
that's a pretty exciting story, though.
I know, but in the grand scheme of my life or, you know, time, that it's one story.
You could have answered that in a very short sentence.
What happened on the plane?
Yeah.
Not much. Everything went fine. I got cleared of everything. The end.
Yeah. But so I do my business in...
Are you watching TV or consuming media or something?
Absolutely binging on TV because that's something I never did. Like, for most of my years when I had kids, you know, that needed looking after, and then my mum got sick and needed looking after, and plus I worked, so I never watched TV. Oh, my God, I love it. I've got my Stan, I've got my Netflix. Love it.
What's your go-to? Or do you, are you a mixed viewer?
All
in one go, or are you going from show to show? Like, are you a binger?
I'm pretty much a binger, yeah. and have to stay focused on my people. Mm. So Friday Night Lights, I'd never watched, and there's 5 seasons of that, and they're long seasons.
Whereabouts are you up to?
I'm done.
Oh, you're done. Yeah, right.
Really sad. I was sad when I came to the end of that.
Is that?
I nearly had to get out of bed. I was like, what now?
It's normally the opposite. Yeah. Normally people are like, I'm so sad I had to put myself to bed. You're like, I was so sad I almost had to get out of bed.
Yeah.
I'll speak so that I'm not giving anything away for anybody. Because I would highly recommend Friday Night Lights. And the thing I would say is the first couple of seasons are amazing. It dips a little in the middle, but stick with it because it comes home very, very strong.
Yeah.
And the final couple of episodes, as a depiction of a marriage on television, I just think it's amazing. But what they do with these characters in the last couple of episodes, where I certainly as a viewer honestly believe something was going to happen, something that doesn't end up happening, but they had told the story so well that I was like, oh, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
And I can see how this is going to happen. And yeah, anyway.
And they twist it. Fabulous show. Yeah, really fabulous.
Okay, well, that's worth staying in bed for. In fact, now that you've reignited, I haven't watched it since it first came out, and now I feel like after the comedy festival, I might treat myself by staying in bed for a weekend and knocking through Friday Night Lights.
Oh, it's so good. And now I've just, I haven't finished it yet, but Wild, Wild Country.
I'm hearing that's amazing. About a cult, yes?
Yes, well, cult.
Kind of.
So people within the cult didn't, religion, yes, thank you. Right. But it's fantastic, and because it's about the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And when I lived, because I lived in a hippie commune in Darwin, hello, and I arrived home one day, because I was the only one in the commune with a job, and I arrived home one day and everything on the clothesline was orange. And the whole place had gone Rajneesh sort of that day and had bought their vat of orange dye and had dyed everything, babies, nappies, sarongs, everything had gone orange, the tablecloth. And everyone in this hippie commune then were saving to go to Pune to see their guru Rajneesh. And whilst I was still living in the commune, the guru Rajneesh pissed off from that ashram. And meanwhile, all these people that I knew had gone off to see him. Anyway, it's a fantastic, my God, this documentary's great. I'm loving that. So I'm back in bed. I'm very happy.
Well, it seems like, I mean, yeah, I can see the lovely little irony that while you were living in a commune, you were popping off to your day job in between, and yet now you're like, you know, having a commune of your own at home, you know.
Yes, taken up that cat, that lifestyle,
right.
That relaxed sarong lifestyle with a vengeance.
So how did you find yourself in a commune in Darwin? What age are you? What time of your life is this?
I was about 23, and I'd been a school teacher. I've told this story is a bit boring because, well, no, because people have heard it. But
well, not everybody. I mean, there's a lot of people who listen to this podcast who, you know.
Have heard my life story.
Well, I mean, of course, I'm sure they all have. In fact, I play all your bits before everybody else's episodes.
Oh, right, of course, yes. But so I was school teaching, and it was my second year out teaching. And I was teaching in a high school in Melbourne, and I hated it. I was really, really unhappy. And I was I'd sort of broken up, but I was in a really awful, well, in hindsight, relationship. I was miserable and would never have done anything about it. This was a thing. I just didn't see that as my role, you know. Like, I just thought, oh, well, this is my lot. And then had a head-on car accident, and my fault, because I was a shocking shithouse driver. And I do a routine about it. I feel goosey doing it.
No, but I like hearing the story because I'm going to ask you some questions about some other things that aren't in the routine.
So. Well, it's so – well, anyway, and but this is the actual sort of routine and reality was I'd gone across into oncoming traffic and I don't know why, and I'd also sped up and I don't know why. I was straight. Like, I didn't do drugs. I didn't drink. And I thought I'd hit a wall, and I at the point of impact – like, I thought, oh, Christ, I'm going to die, and I'm going to die a fucking teacher. And that's my routine, but it was also my real thought, and I thought when I got out of the car, I felt this incredible disappointment with my life. I felt like this is just – I felt in that split second devastated that that was it. I'd had my chance and I'd wasted it. And then I got out of the car – and I thought, oh, this is a miracle. I have not got a scratch. My car's a complete pile of rubble. But, oh, my God. And that's when I turned around and saw that I'd actually hit another car, not a wall. And that's when I actually decided, because I thought I saw children in this car, and I actually decided I was going to kill myself.
Yep.
I thought, there's no way I can bear this responsibility. I've just killed a family. Like, I'm going to kill myself. It was a really firm decision.
Yeah. I totally relate to that. I can imagine that being the way my brain works. That would have been exactly the thing that I would have thought.
Yeah, so
as well.
Relief. Oh, my God, my life. I've got it back. This is a miracle. And then, oh, no, I am now going to kill myself. And then miraculously it turned out there was only one woman in the other car, and she got out without a scratch on her, which was amazing. The car was just flattened. And so then I decided I would quit. Like, no problem. I just thought, well, I can't stay. I quit my job. And I was a real stooge. Like, I didn't know what to do with my money, so I'd saved money. And it turned out my car wasn't registered because I didn't know you had to do stuff like that. I really fucking didn't know that that's what you had to do. So I'm driving an unregistered...
Nice to know we have qualified people educating the nation's children.
I know. Jesus, I didn't know. There I was, a school teacher. Oh, I didn't know you had – I mean, you know, I knew you had to have a – I thought my car was registered. Yeah. Anyway.
No.
So I mean, then look, I was in trouble with the law because I'd caused this accident. I didn't have any insurance third to cover the other car because I didn't have a – wasn't registered. And then I said no problem. And I remember going into the RACV insurance company this other driver was with. And I had a check, I think it was for $8,000. And they went, no, we do this with insurance, we'll cover it. I said, oh, no, I'm paying this. I've got this money from my bank account, I want to give it to this woman. And they went, well, that's unheard of. And I went, I want to do this, I want her to have a car now. So I had no money and I quit my job. And, oh, the question was, how did I end up in the hippie commune? Right. Well, then I was telling a friend who had a job in Darwin in a theatre company, and anyway, and it was and I told him about this. He went back to Darwin, and then I was vacuuming the share house. I know, who vacuums a share house, but I was, and I picked up the front doormat, and there was a telegram that had been there for some days. This is going on way too long, isn't it? Anyway, there was a telegram saying there's a job become available in the Children's Theatre Company in Darwin. Do you want to audition? And I thought I must have missed it because the telegram had been there for days. And anyway, and then they didn't have money to fly me up. So I had to audition in a public phone box in Fitzroy doing monologues on a, because I didn't have a, there wasn't a house phone, a landline or anything. Right. And it was pre-mobile. And pre-computers and stuff.
I mean, it'd be weird if it wasn't pre-mobile and they'd still sent you a telegram.
True, true. So, yeah, so I stood in a phone box in Fitzroy and delivered a dramatic monologue that I'd written myself and a comic monologue I'd written myself. And I think the comic monologue was delivered in an English accent. I don't know why. And I can't do one now. I couldn't do one then. But anyway, I got the job and I went to Darwin. And then...
So, okay, just before we get to the ashram then, Darwin at that time, so I joke of Darwin now, and actually it's one of the things that I actually really like about Darwin. I quite like Darwin. I've had many a good time in Darwin, and the thing that I always say to the, you know, people there is that it feels like you don't ask anyone in Darwin what they were doing before they got to Darwin.
No.
Because so many people in Darwin are there for
they're
some
on the
sort
run.
Of... Yeah, from something. Yeah. From something. Not sometimes illegal, sometimes a broken relationship, sometimes, you know, a life-changing moment or whatever.
Yeah.
But it feels like a place that people go to start again, start afresh, do something different. Was it that then as well?
Oh, yeah, because, I was trying to break free of this relationship. I mean, the guy had already clearly moved on. But I hadn't.
Right.
So that was part of it. And I honestly thought I was going to begin my career in acting by going to Darwin. I mean, I did have a job, but, you know, Darwin's not really LA, I found out.
I mean, it's off Broadway.
Very off Broadway. But, yeah, so it was. It was a new start. It was fantastic, actually. It's where I feel like my eyes were really opened. I did not know Aboriginal people existed.
Right.
Till I went to Darwin. I mean, I kind of knew, but I'd never met an Aboriginal person. I was blown away, like absolutely gobsmacked.
Just that the fact that these people existed or that you had...
Existed, and then we were performing in Aboriginal communities.
Yep.
And it was... And I was doing a show for preschoolers. This was one of the great moments of shame in my life where it was a fun show. It was a really cute show. And often the whole community would come because, you know, it was
a
show. Yeah.
Right.
And you know, they didn't really enjoy it. But it was I'd sort of think, oh, they don't respond the same way as, you know, the white audiences. And then someone said, oh, well, that's because they don't speak English. And I was like, what? You're joking. And it had never occurred to me that people would have not been speaking English at any point.
Who live in Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, I felt such a goose. But I also thought, wouldn't someone have told me from the theatre company before we went in. Anyway, yeah, it was.
You've done The Circle and Studio 10 and shows like that. Like sometimes
yes.
The audience in there doesn't speak much English
yes,
either.
Yes, so. Yeah, true.
They need to bust some people in occasionally to fill out a studio audience. So what did you then learn of that? Like what was your awareness of that culture once you were thrown into it? Like what were your impressions of what was happening in that part of Australia at that time?
Oh, I keep very little of anything. Like I'm not a person who keeps letters or journal. I love throwing stuff out. But I've kept, or my mum actually kept the letters that I sent her and dad from Darwin. And I talk about, I'm obviously trying to get them to understand that Aboriginal people get a hard time and that there's race. This is my very conservative Anglo working class parents who probably were racist and relatives and would say things. So I began this campaign to try and tell them otherwise. So I was really struck by the racism and the segregation. I could not believe that we were segregated in this country. It was my first ever Yeah. But the commune was pretty white.
Okay. So
I didn't hang out with Aboriginal people.
So how do you find yourself in the commune? You get to Darwin, but how does the commune happen?
Well, because as part of my – this is really old shit. like I haven't thought about this in such a long time, but there's certain parts of your life, you know, that are really vivid in memory because so much happens. So I had determined, I was going to have sex with, because this relationship I'd been in was, I think, the only person I'd had sex with. Goodness me, could I really be talking about this with Will Anderson? It appears I am. Going all blushing. Anyway, and I thought, this is ridiculous. I'm 23 years old. I've got to get out there. It's the hippie days. But I didn't really want – I liked love, you know, like I'm a person who wanted to have love and sex, but that wasn't appearing to happen. So I went to a dance and went home with this chap to the commune, and he couldn't get it up. Can you imagine? I've gone to Darwin to have sex and everybody around me is having sex. It's like hippie stuff. It's like, you know – going into one another's bedrooms, and the guy I pick couldn't get it up. And I was devastated, was sure it was me. And then he explained that really he was Christian and he had another girlfriend. But then anyway, he really liked me as a person and asked me to move in, but to another bedroom.
Right.
So I got into the commune that way. And
this is just fascinating to me, but
is it?
It really is.
Are you bullshitting? Like,
I have no reason to bullshit.
No, you don't.
I'm actually doing this of my own free will. I have no contractual obligation to do it.
True.
We've arranged it, and I am the one asking the questions. So we're talking.
Calm down, Will.
It feels. I mean, to me, I just am so interested in the idea of. I guess the whole point of why I started this podcast is that I'm not a religious person. You know, I don't have any particular set of beliefs, but I'm fascinated by beliefs and, you know, groups and what brings people together and, you know, the lifestyle of people who choose to live outside, you know, what the rest of society is doing and how that society operates. You know, those are the things that I am very fascinated by. So the idea of, you know, being amongst a community like that, that is slightly outside society, is just something that I find quite fascinating.
Yes. Well, I think too, because I was brought up Catholic, and in fact, I was very Catholic. You know, I loved being, I loved believing in God. I loved believing in Jesus. I did really contemplate becoming a nun. Like, I loved the thought of going in chapel every day and hanging out and, and then suddenly that all kind of went, I just thought it was, and suddenly, you know, I saw the light, so to speak, and lost faith really rapidly, but quite late in life, like I was 18 or something. And from then on, I was really, like, I must have had a sign on my head, because I ended up at Pentecostal meetings, you know. I really wanted to belong to something. And spiritual. I loved spirituality. I loved believing in something. And but weirdly, remained so cynical. So even in the commune, where everyone around me did absolutely start following the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, who this documentary is about, Wild Wild Country, I never. Never. I just thought, you're crazy. Like, he's, I don't even know why, because I wasn't that curious to find out why he'd fled. I didn't know why he'd fled the ashram, why. But, you know, it was all, he was fraudulent. He was taking money. So I never really belonged. But the communal household I loved living in, you know, this, with all these people and having to fit in. I like that. But we had Because, of course, when I first went there, everyone was nude. Like, that was part of it. Like, I got dressed, obviously, to go to work, but come home nude. And isn't that hilarious? Like, and mind you, everyone had good body. Like, we're all skinny, you
well,
know.
Well, also, if you're going to have to be nude all day, you're probably going to, you know, make sure you eat some healthy food along the way.
Oh, we had to eat healthy right. food.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's we had some good lifestyle conditions.
Well, there were, but then one day, there's a lot of interesting when you live in that sort of environment where one person decides that mattresses are bad. And so next thing you all think mattresses are bad. So this ute arrived because none of us had cars. I don't know who. All the mattresses went off to the tip and we all slept on the floor with balsa wood pyramids over the top of us. Like, can you imagine? You like, there's not even a tiny little bit of foam. It's just the boards and this balsa wood pyramid, like a frame of a tent or something over the top of you. But get this, to get the really good vibrations, this is how dumb I was. You had to sleep with your head to the north and your feet to the south. I'm living in Darwin and I didn't know which way north was. And I was really embarrassed that someone would find out. I knew it was bad that I couldn't figure out how to sleep north, south. Anyway, I just sort of looked in other people's rooms and thought, oh, yeah, that's what I've got to do. And, of course, then within a week, everybody's back is fucked.
Right.
No one can walk because we're on floorboards and we had to start bringing mattresses back in slowly. But, oh, but the balsa, there was a little mini balsa wood pyramid for the yogurt to ferment. The yogurt lived under its own pyramid. You know, and I thought this was all great. I believed it.
So, okay. Well, this brings us very naturally to, you know, at least the conceit of this podcast, which is I'm going to ask you if you have a particular philosophy towards anything. Do you have one? You don't need to, by the way. But is there something in particular that, you know, right now or that, you know, of recent that you, you know, you believe or you would say is a philosophy of yours?
I'm still searching, but I believe in searching for the goodness in people. I guess that's a belief I have. Like, I like seeing the good in people. I enjoy it. You know, it gets a bit harder the older you get to see goodness. But, and I also believe that essentially life's a good thing. Oh, that's bad, isn't it? That's
boring.
But I believe that I guess I grew up in a house where my dad in particular, like, you know, he liked his grog, so maybe that coloured his opinion. But he just saw goodness in everyone. He really did. He was a West Heidelberg footy bloke, drank. But really, everyone was terrific. Just terrific. I never heard him say a bad word about anyone and I just loved everyone. And I guess that's something I aspire to without the beer or the love of – I appreciate football, Will, but don't love it.
But that attitude, like that genuine attitude, like, I mean, we'll talk about, you know, the kind of nature of life a little bit in a minute, but that idea that life, if it is unexplainable and if it is what we get, you know, just working on that as the premise. I'm not saying that is, you know, there's no
way
I would
know. Well, that's how I see it.
That's how you see it?
Yeah, pretty
much.
Yeah,
well, I like to ask people that. Then you have to kind of work out some sort of, you know, way to handle that information and what you do with it. And, you know, being quite grateful about everybody, because I think your dad's probably right. Everyone kind of is terrific if you find the thing that they're terrific at or they're terrific about or whatever. Often even the people that we don't like, it's because of the things that we don't like about them. We're not looking for the thing that's terrific.
Right? Yeah, I except as you're talking now, I think in some ways my dad, Russ, misled me because right. It took me a long, long time and I'm still finding it out that there are assholes.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
And I still am quite shocked every time I have to face that. He needed some discernment. Yeah, yeah, so, right. You know. But I have learned that along the way. But I still, yeah, I still, so I try, I guess, and stick with good people, you know, like hang around with good people and move on from assholes.
Okay, so being part of a community like a comedy community, like how do you feel like you fit into, you know, what we call the comedy community? You know, we go to the start of the festival and, you know, we all go and dress up in a, you know, hospital and get a photo for the Herald Sun, or, you know, we all dress as the royal family and get a photo for the you know, paper, or we do, you know, a gala or some, you know, some such thing together, you know, like something that is, you know, here's the community. And then we all kind of break off into our own, you know, bits and pieces and go off and do our own things. We're in the middle of the Melbourne Comedy Festival at the moment. You and Judith are doing some shows at the Comedy Theatre as part of the Melbourne Comedy Festival. How does that fit into your life, I guess, you know, at the moment? Like, what's your life look like with that in it at the moment?
Well, I've always enjoyed being on the what I would call the periphery of the comedy community, because when I started doing comedy, my kids were little, so I would never hang around, and that was kind of a gift for me because I always felt really quite uncomfortable and as though I didn't really belong. Do you ever get that, or are you?
No,
the comedy community.
No, the thing I love about the Comedy Theatre is that I forget that that town hall exists, and that's where 500 of the shows are. You know, you can go from your bit of the festival, you know, home. There was a time, of course, when I was younger where, you know, I felt like I was, but now I don't really feel like that. And I don't think anybody needs me around at a party. I'm not making a party better.
Get out of here.
I'm not.
Gosh.
Yeah, I like to have, like, I'd prefer to have this conversation with you now, you know, in this environment, rather than have to have, you know.
Oh, at a party.
Try to have a snippet of a conversation with you at a party.
When I started, I was with John, who I've been with now for 37 years. I had my kids that I had to go home to. And I reckon to a degree that's why I hung about in comedy, because I had that – in many ways my aspiration when I was young really was to have a family and a little house. I think it was very similar to my parents. But I got lofty ambitions and threw in the Hollywood actress kind of thing, which was at odds. But in fact, I got the little house – and John and kids. And so that was my base, I suppose, where I felt pretty good about myself. No matter how shit house the house was pretty bad and the kids were covered in eczema and, you know, but I felt like we really did our best, and but the comedy world was always one of pain and sort of turmoil in a way. It was like, oh, God. Nobody laughed tonight, or I've sold 10 tickets, or, oh, what am I doing? I don't know what I'm doing. And so it's always one of anxiety. So, you know, and getting together with other comedians, I enjoyed because, I guess now, like sometimes I'll say to Judith, I guess you're my only real friend in this scene. Like I don't hang out with comedians a lot, do you?
Well, I think that there's a certain time when you have your own families and your own worlds and those sort of things. I mean, you know, the thing I like about, you know, I joke about the photo shoot, but I like that because, you have to all be in a room together for 2 hours, then there's a lot of downtime between when people are getting, you know, makeup and blah, blah, blah. So you can actually genuinely have a bit of a catch up with people.
And that's when I think, oh, these people are really cool. They're really great.
And but I'll see them again in a year when we do another photo.
Although, see, I think because I now, it's sort of a lonely, like there's Rod Quantock and there's me. I love Rod, don't get me wrong, but that's the group we've got to hang out with, really. You know what I like, as far as like age,
it's a seniors tour, kind of, is that what
you know, the age, the you know, then there's Judith, who's like 13 years younger than me, so I guess I've always, and that's the sort of thing I've learnt, Will, and you know, you were saying before about how long do you keep going. The longer you keep going, the more you get the one and only possible job for a person that age. I'm going whispering now. I don't, but I found that. So, you know, if they want an older woman in a TV comedy series, well, there's me. I mean, you could age up Magda. You can you can put a grey wig on Magda, but, you know, otherwise... it's mine. I'm ruthless.
Yeah. Well, you're a core demo. You're, yeah. Like if that demo needs to be ticked. Yeah. I understand that. But I also think that I hadn't quite thought about how, I mean, obviously when you've done it as long as, you know, each generation becomes like, you know, for me now that I'm in my third decade of doing it, of course, there's people who started out and did it for a long time who now don't do it, or they do some other form of it. Yeah. You know, they've become writers or producers, or they've stepped away from comedy altogether. And you forget that. I mean, I think the thing that I was probably thinking is, I feel like I still know a lot of these younger people, but if it's Nick Cody and Daniel Sloss and Becky Lucas and these people who are all having a party, and if you're the... you're the toolie at school this week, you know? It's not like you're not welcome.
Well, you're not going to ask a 63-year-old Becky Lucas, isn't... I mean, she might, but that's like having you... I'm almost grandmother age now. Of, oh, not quite, but, you know, I'm certainly everybody's... I'm older than people's mothers.
Yeah, but I'm older than people's dads now in comedy.
Oh, I can't bear this, Will. See, I look at you and think of you as a youngster.
Well, I would like to think that too, Scotty. You're not true anymore.
Cool.
Performing with Judith, how did that start? Because I'm interested in, like, the collaboration between two people who are individually fantastic and how you... I mean, it's been interesting to see what, you know, Colin and Frank did apart, but I kind of always knew them as, Leno and Woodley first, and then they went apart and did their different things, and now they're back doing Leno and Woodley. But a very different thing for what you and Judith are doing, where you both had your, you know, own very successful and different careers, but have started collaborating together as well.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Oh, well, that started... way back, it was 99 when we did our first show, and that was with Linda Gibson as well, and who, of course, was a comedian.
Brilliant comedian.
Yeah.
For people who, because there may be some people who listen to this who don't know about Linda, but when I first started doing comedy, was like just an amazing hero of mine, because she was like, the stuff that I like, that sort of, you know, she was very political. She was very kind of, you know, energetic on stage in a way that I responded to. And when I was doing my first ever comedy festival show, I had a little meeting with her on Brunswick Street to ask if she would direct it for me. She said no, but still, that's how much I loved Linda Gibb. I was
she would have been smoking her Rolly cigarette. Maybe having a coffee.
Yeah, it would have been coffee, definitely, I would have said.
She wouldn't have started wine till...
No, I reckon it was like
later in the day.
Yeah, I think it was an early morning meeting too, but a hero of mine.
I think for listeners, I guess... I sometimes look at Anne Edmonds and see a bit of Linda. Like,
it's a really good example.
When we started doing comedy, it was with a kind of rawness, and I suppose there wasn't the stand-up form we had to adhere to, and so I feel like Anne Edmonds does that, and
so if Linda, I could just, before we get into Linda, I want to say on that about Edo, is I went and saw her Helen Badu show, the Spinnaker Lounge, the other night, and the thing that I keep saying to people when I want, and I think it speaks to what you're speaking about, is there are so many parts of that show where I was in hysterics. And the thing that kept occurring to me was, I know now why this is funny, but how did she imagine that this would be funny? Like, you know, do you mean?
Yeah.
Once you see it, you go, oh, yeah, this is amazing. But I can't imagine the conception of it. And Linda was very much like that as well, where you'd be sometimes watching her do something where you were like, okay, I get this is funny now that you're doing it and we're all laughing, but I'm just not sure how you had the thought and knew that this was going to be funny.
Yeah, yeah. And Linda always did very outrageous kind of characters.
Yeah.
And, but Linda, so Linda was my peer as far as comedy peer. And Judith, Linda and I were we worked hard, but we didn't we got people to our shows, but we weren't certainly being critically acclaimed. And Judith, in the meantime, was being critically acclaimed. She sold big venues, you know, so she would have been, I don't know how old we all were then, but, and I had this, I had a visual image of the three of us on stage in gowns talking. I didn't know what we were going to be talking about. I just thought, wouldn't it be great for the three of us to be in beautiful gowns talking? And I said this to Linda, and I remember Linda saying, well, why would Judith Lucy want to work with us, Scotty? She's successful. And I said, and then that got me sort of fired up. I thought, well, yeah, but, you know, she might, you know. Well, how are you going to ask her? I remember us having this conversation. I went, well, I'll ring her. Oh, and how are you going to get Judith Lucy's phone number? Because Linda hated herself much more than I hated myself. Yeah. You know, we were really competitive about self-loathing. And anyway, and then I remember ringing Kevin White, Judith's manager, and saying, oh, I've got this idea, and I was just wondering if Judith, and he went, oh, so you want Judith's number, here it is. And then just go, oh, my God, what, he just gave you her number? And then I remember ringing Judith and saying,
I'm not sure Kev would do that these days.
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no, as if, never again. And then, you know, I just said I'd really like to do a show with you and Linda. And she said, oh, what about? And I said, I really don't know. And she went, oh, all right, I'll do it. And we just got together and wrote Comedy Is Not Pretty, which was everything we were told not to do. It was like, well, don't talk about comedy in a show. Certainly don't talk about being women in comedy in a show. And we did it, and because that's what we had in common. And it was fantastic. And because it was really physical, and Judith and I had never been physical, but it was huge. We had huge fights, like physical fights and hurling one another over furniture and, you know, in these long gowns. It was just a dream. And then, of course, we got together to write a second show, and that's when Linda's ovarian cancer had come back, and it was a really the most amazing experience. And that's where Judith and I really bonded, because Linda was dying, and really ill, and we were getting this show together, and it was a nightmare, really, because it was devastating. And she hadn't said, "I'm dying," but we all knew it. Right. And then Linda arrived at rehearsal, and Linda was being very difficult because she was on a cocktail of drugs and facing death, and not talking to friends about it. And she arrived at rehearsals, and she said, "I've got a scene for the show," and it was her on her deathbed explaining what she wanted at her funeral. And Judith and I are in this rehearsal space listening to her, and we hadn't talked. Linda and I had talked about her illness, but we hadn't talked about death. And then it was just this such a time of fucking hell, Linda's dying. And then Judith was amazing. She sort of after a pause said, "Oh, it's really great, but it's a comedy festival. It's got to have a laugh in it." And so Judith did rewrite it, and it was just fantastic. And we had the scene in the show, and we did start talking about death with Linda, but it meant that it had been acknowledged that there was going to be no happy outcome for this situation. And so the scene in the show that Judith was Judith and I having a sort of really huge fight, fisticuffs over Linda in the deathbed over who would do the eulogy, because it was going to be a great gig. You know, Rove McManus will be there for sure, and I need the work. And meanwhile, we'd forgotten all about Linda. And in fact, when Linda did die, Judith and I did do the eulogy together. But it was that point on, Judith and I, it was like this real gift, Will. It was, we got to be part of this amazing woman's death, both on stage and then off. We got to hang around at Linda's house for it was a good 6 weeks in the lead up to her death. And we learned that, because the show we ended up writing and putting on was not a great show. It was really the best we could get together in the circumstances, and it didn't sell very well. But we all of us loved that show, because Linda wanted to do it. She never wanted to give up, because we kept saying, we don't have to do the show. Like, come on. And she went, no, I want to do this show. And it was for Judith and I, like, wow, life is about a lot more than comedy. And we learnt it there and then on the spot, and it was really awesome. And then after Linda died, we, you know, didn't feel right about doing another show together, because it was like the three of us thing. And then finally, you know, you get a bit lonely doing comedy.
Right.
So some years later, Judith and I decided, yeah, so we've done another two. Very long answers, Will. I'm sorry, but...
It's a very long podcast, Scotty, and it's all right. My stomach has been rumbling more in this podcast than usual. I don't know if your stories are making me hungry. Is that what's happening? Hungry for more information.
Yes, for life.
The death thing is interesting to me. This podcast always ends up with us talking about death at some stage.
Does
anyway.
It? And well, what, I've heard somebody always.
Well, because I think that what you think about death often informs how you choose to live your life. Mm. And so I like to, you know, hear what people think about. But also, without putting too much information up the front, I think that the idea of when you're considering your own death versus the death of somebody that you love, you can want to think about death in two very different ways. Yeah. You can be quite practical, I think, about like my own death. I want to be, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I think I'll probably be dead and then I'll just not exist anymore and that'll probably be it. But if someone who I love dies, I don't want to think that. I want to think that, you know, there's something much more to who we are and what we are. So you're talking to me about the death of a, you know, a friend and a colleague and a loved one. So I thought it was just an interesting time to talk about how you feel about death.
I think this is where I sort of have taken to my bed, because when I was growing up, my mum worked in a nursing home across the road from our house. So I spent a lot of my childhood, a lot of time in a nursing home, just hanging out with old people. And it was, well, I call it old-fashioned nursing homes, but it's still similar to today. It's just like I hated it. I would look at these people and dread that that could ever happen to me, that your life became so purposeless and you just hung about in a bed till you died. And I think it really, really has affected me that that's what I'm terrified of. And instead of, I think now in my 60s, I am thinking about the end, and I'm actually really quite scared of death. It's kind of paralyzed me a bit, I think. And I find that really interesting that I'm scared of missing out, you know, of, oh, what, I won't be around for this or this. And you know, this is a stage in life too where you get a little lump or a little skin thing and you think, oh, well, that's it, that's terminal, I'm out. And, of course, and I'm terrified, actually. And I think that's where I'd love to have some spirituality to see me through. But, yeah, I see it pretty much as, well, I'll just be gone. But interestingly, when Linda died, which has been, like, I was with my mum, I've been with a couple of people when they've actually died, but with Linda, what was interesting was she did have a real spiritual kind of awakening. So, and I got to see it. It was, which is the only time I've ever experienced that. And it was really powerful. It was like, wow, because Linda was always very cranky, love, like adorable. We all loved her for it, but negative, you know, and she drank a lot, like, you know, and but by the end, she got too sick to drink, so she'd stopped drinking and got into talking about God, and, you know, she talked a lot about God and came to terms with who God was before she died, and it was to do with, you know, the God is love and love is everywhere and you are God, and I'm like, and this is Linda Gibson on a bed talking like this. So it's, and I hoped I'd sort of see that myself, but it was wonderful to see her go towards death with so much positivity. It was insane. You know, it was, and it was wonderful for those around, but I can't. I don't know. I just see it as, well, that's that done. Having said that, I think, oh, you've really got to enjoy life, because that's what, I don't know what else there is.
That's lovely. I subscribe very much to what you're saying, which is always, when I find it the most lovely is when people reinforce my beliefs. Of course. I'm just going to tell you a quick little story. You said that nursing homes are, you know, essentially can still be the same, and I think that is absolutely the truth in a lot of ways. Where I live in Sydney, well, where I have lived in Sydney, the neighbourhood next to the one that I live in is a, you know, very exclusive sort of neighbourhood, and They have built this, you know, sort of behemoth. It looks like a Westfield shopping mall, but it's a, you know, a retirement home. And, you know, they have live performance and they have like a, you know, shop that sells, you know, gourmet cheeses and kombucha. And, you know, it's the whole sort of, you know, the, but it's still, you know, the, it has the practicalities of being a nursing home. When you walk by and look through the windows, the beds are often hospital beds or if people have their own rooms and these things. But the thing about it that I it just is constantly amusing to me is that, so it's quite tall. So, you know, maybe I'm going to say like maybe 6 or 7 stories. And it's right on the edge of Australia. So that basically if you're on one of those like 4th or 5th, you know, 6th upwards stories, you can see out and basically all you're seeing is the ocean. You know, every day when you open your windows, you have this beautiful view of the ocean. Unfortunately, in between the ocean and the nursing home is a massive cemetery. So it's literally just one of those things where you're like, your view's good if you just keep it at eye level. But if you look down, you are constantly reminded of what the next stage of your life is, which I always think is just such a weird place to build a retirement home, I would have thought. You talk about love. You talk about your family and, you know, raising your family. How long did you say you and John have been together for?
37 years.
So how does that work, 37 years? How does 37 years happen? Because people would, you know, be fascinated by that, I think.
Oh, it's... See, that's... I think we both, weirdly, because we're very different people, but we both wanted to be with one partner, you know, for the rest of our lives, except then, and I've referred to this before, but there were affairs that absolutely, like, it was like, what are we on about, really? We really tore our relationship apart, both of us. And which was weird because we had the kids then and it was quite a happy, or I would have thought a happy place, but I guess in many ways we were going to challenge that normality in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it all went awry, terribly awry, but ultimately we stuck together. But interestingly, just this year, we went to counselling for a year and thrashed all that out. And most of it was about stuff that happened, I don't know how long ago it is now, 20 years ago, 22 years ago, and really mortifying, like, because we were both absolutely mortified. And it was in the last year that we didn't know if we were going to be able to make it through that, because it's like, wow. And you're sort of mortified that you've sat on this shit for so long. And that, I think it was part of the same thing, the dog dying, the kids living overseas, mum, like John's dad had died, he was also very ill. So we'd always been quite busy looking after other people, and we really enjoyed that and did it well together. John in particular is gorgeous at, you know, he really took a lot of care of my mum and his dad and our kids. But then once all that was gone, oh, that's right, it was actually the dog dying that I said to John one day, because I was really depressed after the dog died, like, and we got to a point where we were arguing and we realised that that dog had been providing all the love, you know, like this unconditional love that we both needed. You know, it was like, oh, well, you come home, you've got this dog who loves you and is glad to see you. So, you know, it doesn't matter what John thought or I thought. And when this dog, when Raffy the dog went, because Raffy had been around for 15 years, we were like, oh, God, we've either got to get another dog or go to counselling, relationship counselling. And then we thought, oh, we'll go to relationship counselling. And we were sort of a bit cocky about it. And after the first session, we came out reeling, like, God. But it was really fantastic. It's been fantastic, actually, to mortifying to have to face that you're so flawed and that your relationship is so vulnerable, but really good to get it all out and once again come back to this point. Well, we've got one another, for God's sake. For me anyway, I was sort of visualizing, like, what am I gonna now? What, move into a flat, live on my own? Really?
You could always start a commune.
Back
to Darwin.
Because I'd say to John, oh, you need a woman who plays ukulele and enjoys you playing a ukulele. Because poor John, he's obsessed with ukulele and, oh, plays No Woman No Cry. That was one of his favourites. And I'd be like, oh, fucking stop playing that ukulele. Everything was driving me mad. So we've gone back to this. I have to say, this woman who the counsellor was ruthless. You know, I don't know how much counselling you've done, but sometimes they're really kind of nice, nurturing counsellors. And then there's the ruthless, like, well, I'm not going to take any of your shit.
Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, and obviously different people need different things in different situations. I've been to a few. Some that I found made it worse, and some that I found made it better. Yeah. And you have to kind of find what works for you. I think that occasionally I could probably do with a little bit more ruthlessness, you know.
Yeah.
Because when I am confronted by stuff that – it's very easy to paint a picture in your mind of, you know, how things are. And, you know, sometimes a third party is a good person to come in and go, well – here's, you know, I'm going to really ask you some serious, decent questions here.
Well, what came out in this session, I assume John wouldn't mind me saying, but part of it was it happened after, well, before the Me Too stuff started coming out. But I guess there was this rumbling of women just not really content and happy with the way men in general were behaving. And in fact, John was a product of, you know, growing up in the 50s, and for all his attempts to be a very, you know, feminist kind of guy, there'd been behaviour that was really not at all that way. And a lot of he had to face a lot of that. In this session, both of us together realised that there was this sort of war had gone on, because, you know, I was trying to have a career but having to really do most of the hard yards at home. But he was so bombastic that he'd get credit for just about and that was a war we worked through together. But and I have to say, John was fantastic. But this counsellor, he'd start talking, she'd just sort of shut, nah, bullshit. But that's what he had to deal with, and it was very difficult for both of us.
There must be something about going through that again, though, with somebody. Like, I mean, to really, you know, if you can go through it. Like, I mean, if it isn't the thing that tears you apart, if it's the thing that you come out the other side of, there must be a deeper love and understanding of something that and someone that you can get out of that situation.
And it is worth we'd sort of shoved it aside because it was so long ago, old, and we decided after that there was no more, like, you know, there would be more affairs or that would, if there was, that would end the relationship.
As of now.
Yeah. Think you'd have to announce it again, but so in going back and looking at it, it was, it was more about the sort of people we were and thought we were. And yeah, I was, Anyway, I was throwing that ball up in the air and prepared to have a look at it.
I love you. You're the best. You really are just such an interesting and fascinating person. And I think you're just such a, you know, beautiful, wonderful stand-up comedian. And I'm such a huge fan of yours. You and Judith are doing shows. Still got one more show of Disappointments at this?
No, we've
more?
Got...
How many more have you got?
From one, about four.
Oh, you got four more. Okay.
Four,
well,
or five.
Yeah,
even.
All right. So heaps.
Five.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, well, you've got heaps then. In Melbourne, that is, right?
In Melbourne.
And then have you got other dates around the country?
In New South Wales and then West Australia.
Okay, nice.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
Well, I'll do a proper plug at the start because that's what I like to do as well.
Don't worry about
comedy.com.au, you know, yeah,
yes.
All those sort of things. You know, go there. You'll find all the information you need. Call up Kevin White. He'll give you Denise's personal phone number so that you can give her a call.
Yeah.
thank you so much for being part of this, mate. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Will.